You know, this is a great time, by the way, to be alive as a Christian. If we were meeting here 100, 150 years ago, we would say, well, you know, I've still got Jesus in my heart, and no matter what the world says, it's okay. And you'd have all of these people coming out in scientific world saying, what, you still believe in the Bible? What are you, nuts? We're in the modern age, for heaven's sakes. You know, get with the modern program here. You had Darwin coming along, and you had turn of the century, you had Einstein, and all these people were figuring out how the universe ran. And it looked like there's really no spot for God. Right, it was kind of taking the place of God. We know how it all works now. Well, what's really nice, and this is what's great about being alive now, in the last 30, 40 years, discovery after discovery has come out to say, wait a minute, time out, we're going a little quickly here. The things that you thought you knew about the universe are not true. And the old ways of looking at things, the biblical ways of looking at things, look a whole lot better, look a lot more in line with what's being found out. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Just, we can't do everything, obviously. It's a big topic, so I'm just kind of picking and choosing along the way. But we're going to do like five areas. You can see on your handout here, we're going to talk about, first area would be, what are they learning about the beginning of the universe compared to what they thought at one time? Second area, we'll look at what's going on with the beginning of life. You know, what are they finding out when it comes to getting life started on the earth? At one time, they thought it was a pretty simple proposition. Answer today, not so simple. Third area we'll look at is the big picture. What are they discovering, laws of physics and out into the whole universe as far as the need for a God? Fourth area, we'll go to the small stuff, see what they're discovering on the small level, and that's where the DVD comes in, I hope. Hope we have time and hope it works for that. We will, right? I have till top of the hour?
Absolutely.
Okay, all right. So we'll show you some of that stuff too. And again, if we have time, I want to show you a section here. I just called it, how did I word that? Because I like the line of that. Inconvenient discoveries. Things that have been found out lately, it's kind of oops. You know, I'll give you a real quick preview of that. Do you remember they used to talk about junk DNA? That there were little pieces inside of us in our DNA that didn't produce anything useful, right? It was just chunks of DNA, and everybody scratched their head and they said, what is this doing here? And the biologists who were big on evolution said, that's proof, it's evolution, it's dead ends, you know, things that didn't turn out right. It was just random mutations and they just kind of got added, and pretty soon we got all this junk, you know? Okay, we'll talk about that later too.
I believe everything in the body is put there for a reason, don't you?
Oh yes, and so do scientists now. They've changed their mind on that. So let's go ahead and start in on the beginning of the universe. When I say the Big Bang, you say, well, that's not new. Okay, but I want to show you where we're going with that. I brought in some real exotic, expensive, sophisticated tools to help you today. Here's the first one. This is the Big Bang in a nutshell. What's that?
Paint with polka dots.
Yeah, isn't that lovely? That's the only color I could find. The polka dots represent stars or galaxies. So this is a Big Bang in just a nutshell. Okay, the when they looked out and
you gotta keep going.
Oh no, my lungs aren't what they used
going.
To
be.
You know, so sit there and you'll be going. So in the 1910s, 1920s, as they looked out at the universe and they had better telescopes, maybe some of you have seen up at Mount Wilson up in Los Angeles, it was a 100-inch telescope. First telescope to really be able to look out far enough to notice that stars and galaxies appear to be flying away from us, right? So every dot here, you can see how it starts moving apart from each other. So they're looking at that and they're thinking, what would cause that? And the word was pretty simple. It all must have started back at some point. Little tiny point, right? Much smaller than this. And everything in the universe came into being in one moment, just one flash of
out of nothing.
Doesn't that sound a little bit like Genesis, right? So the part that I think is really interesting was the reaction of the scientists. They did not want to have a Big Bang possible. Now, can you figure out why? Why would they not go for a Big Bang? They wanted what they called steady state. You know, the universe had always been here. Why? I mean, what's the big deal? What's the challenge to them?
Explain how it came.
Yeah, how do you get something from nothing, right? There's a real quick three-part, it's called a syllogism, right? Anything that begins to exist has to have a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore, the universe had a cause. And so they didn't want to think about that, right? Every Big Bang would need a Big Banger, wouldn't it? Okay. If you have infinite time, right, let's say there's no Big Bang, there's no balloon, and it's been here forever, then evolution could work, couldn't it? Because you've got untold zillions of years for it to happen, right? Anything can happen given enough time. But all of that went out the window with the Big Bang. It's now the universe has a starting point. It's not been here forever. Okay, so that's the first step. Now, it's not new, right? So I just wanted to start with that as a background. Gary?
I'm reading the book kind of along these lines. New discoveries for the existence of God.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is the Newtonian paradigm, the universe was infinite and time was infinite in that scenario. And so then you didn't have to have a beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And the change has come about with the Big Bang and with relativity and all these other things.
Yeah. And the reason I mentioned the Big Bang, and yep, the topic is recent scientific discoveries, and I know the Big Bang was much older than that, but it's recent in this way. They've sent satellites up, they've done all sorts of experiments in the last 10 or 20 years, and over and over and over it keeps confirming the Big Bang, right? So it's no longer an untested theory of just a few, you know, crazies off in some university someplace. This is the standard model now. So it's really hard for any scientist to say, well, I still want to believe in an infinite universe. You just don't have that option. There was a starting point.
An awful lot of astrophysicists became theists with the Big Bang, and then the radiation proof afterwards.
Yeah.
One of them I read said it's like looking at the face of God when they confirmed the background radiation, which confirmed the Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago.
One person said, if you want to get an argument with an atheist on campus, don't go to the physics or astronomy departments, go to biology. That's what, yeah. And philosophy, I suppose, or even the English department, come to think of it. But don't go to physics and astronomy, because they're buying into the idea of theism. Now, why is Einstein's name down here? I know he's been long dead, so again, this is not a recent scientific discovery, but I just think it was interesting. Einstein didn't like the idea of the Big Bang either, for the same reasons we just talked about. Philosophically, he was opposed. Not scientifically, he was opposed to it philosophically. So he made his computations different by adding this thing he called the cosmological constant to suggest that there was not an inflation of the universe, that it was just continual. And later on, of course, he was proved wrong, and he said that was the biggest mistake of his life. So, I mean, here he is. He knew it wasn't the right thing to do, but he was so opposed to the idea of a Big Bang and the universe flying into existence, just like Genesis says, that he tried to rearrange. He monkeyed with the computation, with the math, with his equations. So here's a guy as great as Einstein messing around with it.
But go ahead.
What I've read of Einstein, he was a theist.
Yeah, he was just, he couldn't handle the problem of evil. That was the biggest thing that he really refused to come to the Christian God. Yeah, I think you're right on that.
I didn't want to mess up this discussion, but I know on TV they analyzed Einstein's brain. Mm-hmm. Do you know what they came up with on that? Why was his brain different from our brain? I don't either.
No.
I didn't catch it.
Yeah, I mean, he actually, they donated his brain. I don't know if it was with his assent or not. I guess it didn't really matter. But I just want to show you that this argument has not gone away. Let's bring it up to modern times. Third person, or third section down there under A, is Stephen Hawking. Do you recognize that name? The Cambridge physicist, as Homer Simpson called him, the wheelchair guy. Okay, so Stephen Hawking is a brilliant, brilliant guy, but he does not want this universe to have come out of nothing, because it makes God show up, doesn't it? So he's got a book out, brand new book, last year it came out, it's called The Grand Design. Feel free to take a look at it, but I would just suggest it's been shot down by just about anybody in the know, not just Christians, but other people who are physicists call it crazy, because here's his idea. He says, well, the universe really didn't come from nothing, it sprang into existence because of laws of gravity. Now I want you to think about that for a minute. If you have a law of gravity, does that do anything? It has to have something to act on, doesn't it? You can't tell the law of gravity until I bring this in and drop this, right? Then you got a law of gravity operating. But if you got nothing, what would law of gravity do? Absolutely nothing.
Well, the Big Bang accounts for the four forces. Including gravity.
Yeah, including gravity. That's right. So it was just a really sad attempt, and everybody's hoo-hawed this thing off stage, you know, but it was a big book for a while. Oh, Hawking has figured a way around the problem of the beginning of the universe. No, he hasn't. So if any of your friends ever talk about, boy, look at this new Hawking book, just say that's really been refuted. It's pretty simple. How can nothing produce something? Right, we're back to that question again.
Now, two other things. This book I'm reading point to a beginning, hint to the beginning, the string theory and the quantum theory, which are relatively new in the last 50 years.
You know what's cool about string theory? String theory says that there's a bunch of... I'm losing my track of... we got the...
Dimensions,
thank you. That there are a whole bunch of dimensions that when the universe got started, there were extra dimensions and they're all folded up on a really, 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 really tiny scale. And I mean, think about where, who else is in extra dimensions? God is. And so in a sense, the proof, or at least I like to think of it that way, the proof that there are extra dimensions and God would be one of these may exist within this rolled up stuff that's really, really tiny. Think about Jesus coming into a room when it's locked. You can do that with extra dimensions. In fact, somebody said there's a film trying to visualize that you can take a basketball and turn it inside out. If you have extra dimensions, you can rotate it through these dimensions. Okay, I don't know. But at least, you know, if there are four dimensions, then God has to be outside of those, doesn't he, to create the universe that we have. So, yeah, I think that's interesting. Anyway, so there's Stephen Hawking trying to work this thing out. He's not having a lot of luck with it.
To encapsulate the Big Bang, though, they say all mass, energy, time...
And space.
And all the forces came out of that infinitesimally small point in time.
Yeah. Wild, huh?
Everything came out of that.
Yeah. Just don't stand nearby when it goes, right? All right, so we're going to look at B here, which is the beginning of life. What's going on as far as theories and how are they doing with that? I wanted to back it up again, if that's okay, and give you a little background on the move it to today and what's going on. Back in the 1950s, there were two scientists, Miller and Urey. Those names ring a bell at all. They got together and they said, let's see, we need to get amino acids, right? Because if we can create amino acids, we can turn them into proteins and that can form life. So how do we get amino acids? So they took a flask and filled it full of the atmospheric gases that they thought were present on the early Earth, methane and oxygen and nitrogen and all that kind of stuff. And they put a little electrode and they sparked it, bzz, bzz, like it was a lightning storm out in, you know, real life. And they got this gooey, tarry mess on the bottom, and they looked at it, and lo and behold, those were some amino acids. And everybody was excited. So in the 1950s, again, the word was, hey, we don't need God, right? We just need lightning. We got to get these gases here, and then you get the amino acids, and they wake up one day, and they form proteins, and you get life, right? Everything's good. Okay, since then, two discoveries. One is, just because you get these gooey amino acids doesn't get you life at all, right? It's way, way more complicated than that. That's not just like step one, step two, we got life. So that's been a problem. Secondly, there was the wrong gases.
Yeah.
So now they've discovered the early Earth was very different. They cannot, and I repeat, they cannot get that kind of gooey stuff to form again. So both, I think it was Miller, finally said, yeah, this is a dead end. I mean, he gave up on his own stuff. So if anybody throws that Miller-Urey thing at you, it's history. It's ancient history. It doesn't work anymore. In fact, I wanted to quote something to you here from Francis Crick. Does that name ring a bell?
Yeah.
The DNA co-discoverer. Well, he didn't discover it. I mean, he discovered the way it was organized, the double helix and all. Here's what he said. Every time I write a paper on the origins of life, I swear I'll never write another one because there's too much speculation running after too few facts. Okay, so this is Francis Crick throwing his hands up. He's not happy with this. Now, he's not a Christian, right? I want to make sure that I'm telling you things that these are non-Christians that are talking. So it's not just some kind of viewpoint that's slanted because they want to believe a certain way. These are people that are drag-kicking and screaming to these conclusions. Here's another man, Michael Denton. He's not a Christian. You can look these people up if you want, do your own search on them. He said the complexity of the simplest known type of cell is so great that it's impossible to accept that such an object could have been thrown together suddenly by some kind of freakish, vastly improbable event. Such an occurrence would be indistinguishable from a miracle. Hey, you hear that word miracle? Isn't that great? That puts him right next door to Christianity, doesn't it? He says, gee, it's indistinguishable from miracle. And then we turn around and say, that's what we've been saying for thousands of years, right? Somebody once said, it's almost like imagining a tornado comes into a junkyard, and as it leaves behind a 747. Right? You take bits and pieces of something, and it all comes together a certain way in a certain function. You go, how could that be? Right? Then nobody's going to see a junkyard set of parts turn into a Ford or a 747 or anything like that. Did you know once in a while, I think it's like every 2 or 3 years, the scientists that like to do this kind of research on origin of life have get-togethers. And just recently they had one down at UC San Diego. It must be very frustrating. They get together and they have all these great ideas, and after 2 or 3 days they've shot down each other's ideas and they walk out with their heads down. And they say, well, maybe next time. And this has gone on, this has gone on, and this has gone on. They've gotten so frustrated because there's nothing that has been established that could even possibly be the origin of life. You can't get life going, at least if you do it naturally, right, through just natural processes. In fact, one person here who's the chair of the National Academy of Sciences reviewing origin of life research said, the simplest bacterium is so complicated from the point of view of a chemist, it's almost impossible to imagine how it happened. Now listen to that. He can't even imagine, he says, how it happened, much less making it happen. So there we go, right? These are people that are in the field that scratch their heads and they're just throwing their hands up. They have no idea. In fact, they're so frustrated now they brought out the idea. Do you see my next point down there, panspermia? Does that sound familiar at all? Some of them are saying, look, okay, we can't figure out how life has happened here. Maybe this happened. One day, there's life on Mars, a big asteroid smashes into Mars, a piece of Mars flies off and it lands on Earth eventually. Or maybe there's a comet, and the comet goes by and it smacks into the Earth and it had the seeds of life. And that's how Earth got started with life here. Okay, I mean, there's a major problem with that. Anybody see the...
You have to go back. Where did that come
from? Where'd that life come from, right? It's like that just removes the problem one step. Yeah, it was the Martians. How'd the Martians get here? All right, so, but I mean, that's one attempt.
Who was the writer from Lehigh University? Irreducible?
Yeah, like, Behe.
What was his name?
Michael Behe.
Michael.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about him here in just a sec. In fact, on the video we have something on Behe. Then the people who believe in panspermia have gotten more desperate, right? There's something called directed panspermia. And Crick is in this category. I don't know if he was kidding or not, but he said maybe an alien spaceship came by and dumped its holding tanks full of bacteria onto the Earth. Right? They were going around kind of like Johnny Appleseed, kind of a high-tech Johnny Appleseed, sort of seeding life on Earth and seeding life here and there. Okay, that's how desperate they are. I mean, now we're in science fiction, right? This is science fiction realms.
Well, that's a UFO belief system. You can find it in their books.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But it doesn't get rid of the problem, no, does it? I mean, where the aliens come from, of course, that's...
That.
Yeah.
But philosophically, you can't regress that way indefinitely.
That's right. Yeah, that it's a bad argument.
Not accepted.
No, it won't work. And looking for life. How are they doing looking for life other places, right? If life is so simple and it's so easy to get started, boom, you just spark it with a bit of lightning and you get these little amino acids and they just grow up and be happy, healthy adults. How does all that happen? Does it happen really often? Well, again, 50 or so years ago, they started the SETI project, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and they set up these big disks and they're listening to all the stars. And they're trying to get signals in. If you ever saw the old movie Contact with Jodie Foster, that was the principle, right? They're listening. And they're going to get a lot of static, but all of a sudden, do you remember what they heard on, or what she was picking up? It wasn't just random noise. Okay, it's been a while. That's a pretty good movie. You ought to take a look at it. Because it gets into philosophy. They got prime numbers. Prime numbers started coming in.
Yeah.
Take a look. I won't spoil any more of the movie, but take a look at it sometime because it's Carl Sagan, total atheist, who wrote this. But it's interesting what they talk about here. So SETI was set up to try to interpret and hear some of these signals. Well, guess what? They've done it for 50 plus years. They've had telescopes all over the world. They've listened to thousands of stars. They've tried different wavelengths. And you know what the result is right now? Right. I mean, you would have heard it, right, if they found something. They found nothing, right? Zero.
I got one of these where we live in Ohio.
And
I knew a fellow that was you know, on there listening.
Yeah. But no luck at all. Now you say, well, maybe we're just not focused, you know, in the right spot of the heavens. Okay, I want to read something again to you. He's not a Christian. A guy named Paul Davies, you ought to look him up sometime. He's a really sharp person. He writes some terrific books. He's an astrobiologist. He's a physicist. He's a professor at the Arizona State University. So he writes well. He writes a lot. People like what he has to say. This just knocked me out. This came out last year. It was a book of his. It's called The Eerie Silence. Here's his result, right? Here's a guy that wants there to be life out there, wants it to be easy, doesn't really want God to be involved, and this is his conclusion. We are probably the only intelligent beings in the universe, and I would not be very surprised if the solar system contains the only life in the universe. Isn't that astounding? Now think, SETI people are still going to want a lot of money to go into their program because they say, yeah, but what if? NASA is spending a gob of money to go to Mars and different places. Again, it's the what if. You know, maybe we'll find some form of life there. And that's okay. I like the space program. I think good things come as a result. But it's just interesting to me that a guy like Paul Davies is saying just flat out, we're probably it, right? So forget all the little green guys running around. Forget all the Star Trek and Star Wars and all that kind of stuff. We're probably it. Now, that's got to be opposite of what he really wanted to say. His heart probably wanted him to say something different, but this is what he's saying in a new book. And this was actually in Air and Space Museum magazine's, Air and Space, this book report, and those lines. I took it right out of that. I thought, what? Air and Space, right? I mean, they're a pretty secular group of people, but they're reporting in this guy's book.
Well, what did you mean by aliens?
Well, you know, any kind of life form that they've done in movies over the years.
Plant, insects, water.
He's saying we may have the only life, period, including everything from.
I agree with him. And, yeah. But, you know, they always want to act like we've got aliens out there.
Sure.
And they're flying around and they're going to land. And.
Well, like Ron said, too. This alien philosophy is that they will help us, right? They will save us.
Yeah.
They will be the gods from the skies come down and reveal knowledge. We go, oh, if we'd only known, you know, and they'll solve every problem we've got. So it's not going to be the God of the Bible. It's going to be the God of...
Who's into that, too? We had a next-door neighbor. Incredible. They would go to conferences all over the country. Conferences. They were really into that.
It's a religion. It is. It's definitely a religion.
It's a big deal.
Yeah, it's next door to Scientology. It's very much like Scientology, which is also a space age religion.
But that goes against God, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah.
Well, clearly.
Yeah. Well, let's look at the large. Okay, so now we've looked at the universe starting and life on Earth starting. It looks like, again, the Christian view is holding sway. What about focus on the large, right? Looking at the big stuff. Well, I got a quote from a couple of people here. Here was one complaint that was brought up. Oh, there's got to be life all over the place. Why? Because we're in such a tiny corner of the universe. Why would you have this whole big monstrous universe and one little chunk of has life, right? So here's a physicist, Victor Stenger. If God created the universe as a special place for humanity, he seems to have wasted an awfully large amount of space where humanity will never make an appearance. How about Stephen Hawking again, backed by popular request? He said, our solar system is certainly a prerequisite for our existence, but there does not seem to be any need for all those other galaxies. Okay, you know what they've discovered in the last several years? These people are wrong. You need this much stuff, you need this kind of universe, the way it's expanding, to have life. You can't have life. I mean, I don't understand why. I haven't gotten into all of the research on it. I'm not going to kill myself off doing it. But the current finding is you need this much stuff to create the kind of universe that we're in.
Well, some even propose multi-universes.
Yeah, which is funny, because that's
not only galaxies, but multi-universes. More universes.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a fallback position for those that look around and say, well, yeah, this universe is good for us. Maybe there are other universes where we wouldn't be here, but something else would be here. But do you notice that's called a metaphysical concept because it's nothing to do with physics. We can't discover it, right? You can't get a big enough telescope. You can't develop a great spaceship to get out there. If it's another universe, we're trapped in this one. So why talk about it? Right, so it, to me, that's a real cheap way out because they don't have to ever prove that.
I think it's been rejected.
Yeah, although people will cling to it. Well, the other thing that they're finding now that they look out at the universe is that so many of the parameters of every kind of physical law, for example, has to be exactly right for life to be here. And every time they look at these parameters, the parameters are set for life to be here. And so what I did is I ran off two sets of them. This one has, let me show you here. I think I quit on this one. And this one has 140 right now, and it keeps growing. 140, what would you call it? It's characteristics or constants of the universe. I'll just rattle off a few. I'm not going to do 140 for you here. But did you know the nuclear force, strong nuclear force, which is one of the four forces, has to be a certain strength? If it's off just a little bit, either stronger or weaker, you don't get life. The gravity. Kind of gravity we have. You say, well, gravity's gravity. Yeah, but it could be anything, couldn't it? It could be a lot stronger, it could be a lot weaker. If gravity around the universe was different by just the tiniest degree, right, like a dial, and you just barely move the dial, you don't get life.
Yeah, well, not on the gravity bit, but we're just slightly stronger. I mean, like 1%. The Big Bang couldn't have happened because it wouldn't have had enough force.
That's right. The stuff would just stay together, and you'd have a big...
It would have blown so fast apart that it couldn't have coalesced into systems.
That's right. Systems. And that's just one. And things like the velocity of light. Apparently that has to be a certain speed or you got problems. You don't get life. The kind of radiation that's in the universe. The distance between the stars. Water molecules, how they're put together. The kinds of supernova explosions that go off out there, the temperature background in the universe, dark energy, or something called dark energy. So I won't bore you with this, but I thought it was interesting. I ran them off, 140 of them. That's out in the big universe. But if we just bring it into our own local background, this is what knocked me out. I just quit running this thing off because I didn't want to kill off my printer. They have 402 parameters that have to be exactly right for our Earth to have life. In other words, if you just look at us locally, not out in the whole rest of the universe. I mean, some of you probably already know some things. What has to be good as far as the way the Earth is just to have life? We have to have a certain kind of sun. We have to be at a certain distance from the sun. Our sun is a very stable star.
We have to have food.
Yeah, there's got to be food.
Speed of our orbit, as well as the speed of our turning and the axis.
Exactly, you got to tilt.
All these kinds.
You got to rotate at a certain speed. You revolve.
You have to have air to breathe.
Yeah, you have to have the right kind of atmosphere. You have to have a big planet out beyond Earth because it catches all the meteors and all the comets come plunging in. You got to have a certain number of planets.
We need water.
Yep, you got to have water in a liquid state.
Without water.
Yeah, it's got to be in a liquid state, though.
I think water, and I think there's one other element, are the only elements that expand when they get colder at the freezing point. And if water, when it turned to ice, didn't expand, then all the ponds in the winter all over the Earth would freeze solid. But because it expands, you get an airspace underneath and it preserves life underneath.
Yeah, and you have to have a planet that has seismic activity. You have to have a planet that has certain lightning characteristics. You have to have planets that have plate tectonics. And you go on, and you go on, and you go on for hundreds of them. They have to be exactly right. And again, I won't bore you here, but it's all online if you ever want to find them.
It's called a privileged planet.
Yep.
Yeah. Really,
yeah. The beauty of this, you mentioned a lot of things that are tragic. But they were in themselves, but must be there for renewal.
Like seismic activity. Yes.
It's self-sustaining.
That's right. People say, why would God, on and on?
God's sustaining.
Yeah, exactly.
We need the man, the woman, to have children.
That's right.
In order to keep everything going.
Yeah. I mean, the list is just endless.
It has to be there.
Yeah.
You can't do it alone.
Let me bring Paul Davies in one more time here. This is what he had to say about this fine-tuned universe. He said, there's powerful evidence that there's something going on behind it all. It seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming. Now, why won't these people, I think it's just a heart issue. You know, why they look out there and they say, boy, sure looks design, but, and then they always take a step away from it. Now, some do commit to this, but some don't. A famous person actually committed himself at least a step forward instead of a step back is Antony Flew, F-L-E-W. He was probably the premier 20th century atheist philosopher. Atheists all over the world looked at Antony Flew for good arguments for atheism. Well, people kept throwing this design argument in his face. He got into some debates with Christians, and he wrote a book not too long ago. He passed away a year or two ago, but he wrote a book before he died, and he gave up on atheism.
Good.
He said, "I'm not an atheist." Now, he didn't get all the way to Christianity. He said, I'm a deist. I think there's a God, and kind of like a clockwork. He kind of got it all started, and then he walked off. So we don't know what happened right toward the end of his life, but boy, that's a huge step, huh? To go from atheist to at least admitting, okay, I'm open to it now. And he said it was the fine-tuning arguments that we've been talking about here, that's what changed him.
On television the other day, I saw this article on porpoises. You know, they don't have gills. They have to come up to breathe.
Yeah.
So what do they do when they sleep? How do they breathe when they sleep? And apparently they have two cycles in their brain that allows them to come up and breathe. But the explanation was, well, over millions of years, they've learned that if they stay down there, they die. That's the evolutions.
Oh, okay.
Well, poking fun at the evolutions.
Now, let's move on to the focus on the small, which is D, looking at the small stuff. So, as they look out, the physicists look out the big world and they say, wow, it seems to echo ideas of design. Same thing is happening, and again, it's only been the last 20, 30 years that they've developed the tools to be able to look at the cell, especially. I mean, remember, I don't know about you, but when I grew up, it's sort of like, well, here you got a cell, it's got a nucleus and some protoplasm and the edge of it, and there you go, right? It seemed like an egg, kind of a yolk, and it looked pretty simple, right? And that's what scientists used to think. In Darwin's day, hey, there's not much to it, it's just a sac, a little protoplasm, a couple minor chemicals, and that's the way the cell works. And of course, you know as well as I do now, they're taking the cell apart and they're going, holy cow, there's a lot of stuff going on here on the small scale. It's like a little city, right? It handles its waste, it transfers things around, and it duplicates itself. I mean, that's just amazing. I don't think we're going to have the time for it, but I would just recommend, maybe some other time I come in here, I'll get that thing up and running. But there's a short video here that anybody would enjoy. It's not like a hardcore Christian video that pounds on people and tells them they got to be saved, right? So it's not that kind of video, but it looks at and uses some of the most amazing computer designs to talk about what's going on the cellular level. And it's got the most amazing computer-generated sequence of showing how DNA replicates itself. It's powerful. And so this is really good stuff that you can give to a neighbor and just say, you're interested in biology or anything. It's very non-offensive, and it will get them thinking big time. So I would recommend that. But there's a man that Gary already brought up. His name is Michael Behe. And he was looking at the small-scale stuff inside the cell. And he came up with this concept. He called it irreducible complexity. He said there are certain systems that operate. For example, the eye, blood clotting, just different things that work in your body that need more than one thing. If evolution is true, this stuff has to evolve, right? I mean, that's what evolution is based on. But how would these things all evolve at the same moment? It's the only way it's going to work, if they all evolve at the same moment. So let me give you an illustration. Okay, this is a mousetrap. So let's assume, so we're going to pretend that it'll become a system, right? Someday it'll evolve. So the first thing that evolves is the piece of wood. Okay, so can this catch any mice?
No.
Maybe, but not by itself, right? So this doesn't work by itself. So maybe a few million years go by and a spring evolves. Okay, we're going to catch any mice with this? Maybe we need the little bait piece, right, for it to getting closer? Okay, so his point is you can't evolve independently, which is supposed to be what happens in evolution, right? Piece by piece, just kind of happens and it all comes together and bingo, you get a mousetrap. You don't. You only get a mousetrap if somebody designs all these pieces to function together.
puts them.
And puts them together. And that's where this comes in. This is going to talk about something called the molecular motors that are out there in the small scale. Just do a Google search. Type in molecular machines. Or type in bacterial flagellum. It's a little whip tail on bacteria that helps them get through the water. It's like an outboard motor. You'll see if I have a chance sometime to show you the video, or if you take a look at this, or just go online. Just type in bacterial motors. It's a flagellum. It's a little whip, and the whip operates like an outboard motor. This thing spins around up to 100,000 RPM, and within a quarter turn, it can go backward 100,000 RPM. Try that with General Motors, right, or Ford Motor Company. They can't do that. This thing is doing it. And you look at the illustration, because now they've got some high-power microscopes and stuff. You look at these illustrations. Oh, there's actually an illustration on the back there. I don't know if you can see that. It looks designed, right? It's got a stator and a rotor, and it's got a shaft, and it's got this hook, and then it's got the whip that comes out there. And this thing is amazing. So this is what they're starting to see on the molecular level. Okay, let me keep moving on that. Second thing, of course, they're finding on the small level is DNA. Yes?
I have one experience for last year, just like that. That doesn't work. You brought that thing is for the fish mouse like that.
Yeah.
My brain was like that. 6 hours, I was lost in my memory.
Oh, really?
Last year.
Wow.
Then,
wow.
I don't remember anything for 6 hours because I was in a funeral, Marilyn work funeral last year. That day, I was suddenly so sad because she was my Bible study lady, so she just gone, and I was so sad. Then 1 minute, the lady is singing and the piano and everything, and just that time, it just, I lost the whole thing. It's, I don't know what happened. As my friend, they took me to the Palomar Hospital. They put it into me, all kind of, you know, like tests and everything, but I didn't have nothing wrong with me. But 6 hours to me is, it's just like God saying, one day is just like 1,000 years, 1,000 years one. My 6 hours was just 1 second. Bingo, that's just, everything is working together, it's coming back, my memory.
Wow.
Yeah, so I believe those stories, God, something inside of my brain is something. I'm still, that's a mystery about my brain.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
Well, if you invite me back someday, I've got a talk on the existence of the soul. Because that's a hard sell these days. People look at us and say, oh, we're just all meat, right? Just, that's it. You die, you go in the ground, and you rot, right? Because this is it. This is all we see. But there's some really good arguments for the soul. Not just Bible verses, but some arguments you can make for the existence of the soul. All right, so DNA is a pretty good argument, isn't it? Because it's a computer code. Right, you got four different things that are coded chemicals.
It is there.
It's a code, right? It tells the cell tells it what to build. And again, if we have a chance sometime, I'll show you the DVD of that. Bill Gates called it the most complicated computer code ever. Hey, I trust Bill Gates. Right? If he thinks it's complicated, it's complicated. Notice every computer code needs a designer, right? Somebody's got to engineer this thing. So where'd all this information come from, right? All of us are walking pieces of information inside of us to design us.
If you look at the double helix, it's marvelously simple.
It is. Yeah.
Simplicity.
Yeah, it's the most complicated and the most simple form possible. I mean, you can wind it up inside your body.
Is DNA just unique to each and every one of us? It's all unique, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't just that, one of a kind.
That's right.
In a way.
Yeah.
All these little strands.
It's wild stuff. Okay, I knew it. I was going to run out of time here. Let's just do the last one here as far as under D. Something, again, that's come along lately because of these discoveries is called the Intelligent Design Movement. And there's an organization called Discovery Institute up in Seattle. And if you want to find out more information, they're the leading organization behind intelligent design. Basically, what intelligent design says is this world and everything out there looks designed, but it does not move you to Jesus Christ, right? So I'm just telling you that. That's not their purpose. They don't take you that final step. They just get you to think that there's got to be an intelligent designer. But they get a lot of heat anyway, because a lot of scientists don't want to go that direction, right? So there's a lot of flack for them. But they're the ones that produce things like this. They have tons of books and DVDs. They're all excellent. They're high quality material. So that's a good thing, right? So we're starting to see some people on our side who are sharp people. These are not just, you know, people sit in pews and raise their hands and thank Jesus. I mean, these people go do research, and they're convinced that there's proof of the existence of God out there. So I'll save the inconvenient discoveries for another time. And at the bottom, I just put some of the resources, Emmanuel Faith, our website here at the church. You click on the resource button, it pulls up the apologetics as one of your choices. Click on that, and then you go to apologetics resources, and it's got a list of books in the area of science that I hope you think about doing. So, good time to be alive, really. And we can, you know, the nice thing is we can have confidence. Our faith is not a leap in the dark. More and more science is actually coming on our side. So that's the good news. So.